Join the conversation at everydaynovelist.com. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find the host at J.D. Sawyer on Minds.com, or hit him up at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 646. Today, Sarah asks...
My next question is about writing believable geniuses or the exceptionally gifted. Hollywood relies heavily on a number of tropes that don't feel very realistic to me. Could you talk a little bit about how people like that would fit in with the people around them?
Well, the thing to remember about geniuses is that genius is a manifestation of a quality called, by psychometricians, G, which is general intelligence. IQ does not exactly measure general intelligence, but it measures an aspect of it that makes it close enough for government work. It's very hard to measure G on its own. So, to give you an idea of the way that things work for people who are super high in IQ, you talk geniuses, you're talking people of about 135, 140. Okay, so the IQ distribution breaks down, like, below about 80 is severe mental retardation. 100 is about the baseline average score, which means you get a lot of people below it and a lot of people above it, but 100 is designed to be pegged as the average so that you can easily reference it. So someone of average intelligence who hits that average just spot on is 20-odd points above someone with severe mental retardation. And that 20 points gives you that much of an increase in functionality and your ability to abstract. What IQ does is it allows you to abstract, to deal with representations of the world without them being concretely tied to the world, or indeed to deal with representations that aren't concretely tied to anything, as happens with mathematics, for example. 120 is above average. It's as high above the average as the average is above severe disability. That's when you hear someone is gifted, someone is smart, the IQ proxy is they're above 120. And they have as much of an advantage over the theoretical average person as the theoretical average person does over a typical severely retarded person. And I am using retarded here in the clinical sense. Please don't write me in about using a slur. Mental retardation means a retardation in the development of the mental and neurological meat. And some people are born with severe retardation, and people who aren't, but who are below average intelligence or who are otherwise affected by birth defects, Down syndrome, whatnot, get called retard on the playground, which is why the term has fallen into disrepute in some circles. But it is a descriptive term describing an actual neurological thing, and I'm using it in that sense. It's called a term of art. So someone who is above average, who's considered smart, is as much smarter than the normal person, than the average person, as the average person is smarter than someone who is severely retarded. Then we move up the scale. 130, you get borderline genius. 135 to 140, you get genius. And once you get above 140, you're talking about the top 1% of intellectual horsepower of anyone who has ever lived. Not just of people alive now, but of anyone who has ever lived. And the IQ scale goes up to about 200, after which it kind of breaks down. But there are people who have measured and pegged the scale, and I've known a few of them personally. The higher you get up the scale, the more easily you can deal with abstraction, and the more you have to deal with abstraction in order to keep from becoming severely depressed. Now, for a lot of people who are way high up the scale, this causes major social disability because they have difficulty relating to the people they grew up with because they literally grew up in a different world from all their peers. This is not something that will always happen. If your peer group growing up are people who are closely related, then, especially if they're closely related and from the same culture group, then you are unlikely, even as a genius, to be a major outlier. you might be a little ahead of your peers, or noticeably ahead of your peers, but you're not so far ahead in terms of the horsepower that's spinning in between your ears that you grow up in a fundamentally different universe. And to give you an idea of what I mean by a fundamentally different universe, a border collie's IQ is 20 to 40 points. An average person's IQ is 100. So someone who has an IQ of 160 is living in a universe that looks to them as different from the average person's as the average person's universe looks from a border collie's universe. That's a real huge difference. The problem is not that smart people are assholes. The problem is that the smarter you get, the more likely you are to be socially maladaptive. Because in seeing the universe so fundamentally different from your close peers, you miss out on the parts of development that happen after you're born, the socialization that allows you to interact fully with the world. The people who are really high IQ and highly functional, and there are a lot of them, are people who grow up in situations where they are not major outliers in their peer groups. What you'll find among those more grounded types is that they inhabit an intellectual universe that's really rarefied, but they have no problem dealing with common people, normal people, people in the average to above average range, maybe even people in the below average to retardation range. Because they had good, solid social development, they can connect with people in ways other than intellectually. But if they did not have good, solid social development, they do not feel confident in areas that aren't intellectually rich. And so they tend to be shy, standoffish, assholey, or otherwise socially maladaptive. They're generally not psychopathic. It's actually fairly rare to have a psychopath who's also a genius. When it does happen, it's terrifying and fascinating, but it's fairly rare. More often, your psychopaths tend to have below average to above average intelligence, and the ones with above average intelligence who have been well socialized tend to be good community leaders, ruthless business people, really, really hotshot snipers, people like that. And your below average types tend to be your street criminals and repeat violent offenders. Those aren't the only things that, you know, psychopathy plus intelligence are not the only things that predict these things, but that's just an example of the stereotypical evil genius is very, very unusual. Mostly you either get the reclusive genius or you'll get someone who has what used to be called the common touch, which was a term that was applied in the 19th century to aristocrats who preferred the company of the commoners to the company of their own class. The smartest person that I am aware of alive in the United States right now, for example, pegs way off the IQ scale. They don't make tests that can test him. And he, if I remember correctly, lives on a small ranch in the middle of Missouri and prefers socializing with other farmers. And he spends most of his time trying to reconcile higher mathematics with Christian theology.
For a good fictional variation of that type of person, look at Christian Kane's character in The Librarians. Christian Kane plays a character who is like 180 IQ, fascinated by art history, and he works on an oil rig in the Midwest.
And you get people like that. One of the smartest people I know is a world-class archaeologist specializing in medieval France and ancient Carthage. He's also done some fantastic discovery work early in his career in, was it Syria? I think it was Syria or elsewhere in the Levant. But what he does for recreation, or did when I was in his orbit, he hand-carves furniture and illuminates it with Sanskrit and Greek and other exotic alphabeted languages. If I remember correctly, he did one for his wife, which is festooned with ancient erotic poetry in other languages as an anniversary present or a wedding present. He has this strange hobby of playing the recorder, but he doesn't play the recorder like we all get as kids. It's as stocking stuffers. He has a collection of recorders ranging in size from 3.5 feet long to like an inch. And he can play all of them, and he can do symphonies on all of them. And he just does this stuff for fun. because what it takes to engage the horsepower in a way that's satisfying is a level of complexity that most people simply don't have access to. And the further up the IQ scale, and if I remember right, it's like 180 or 190. He's super, super smart. The further you get up the IQ scale, the more that's the case. The things that divert you and amuse you are either the highly visceral, meaning sex and drugs and extreme sports and that the stuff that's utterly absorbing, or the highly abstract, higher mathematics, very intricate music, anything involving complex symbol systems. This is why you find so many conspiracy theorists in the Mensa community, because the symbol systems, and occultists, because the symbol systems are so complex as to be sort of infinitely rewarding. There's this rabbit hole you can dive down into that yields an endless source of insights and epiphanies that may or may not have any connection to reality, but they don't actually need to in order to be interesting, any more than the fictional characters that you and enjoy in books need to have much of a connection to reality for you to get a high out of solving a mystery or solving a puzzle or watching them overcome obstacles. So in terms of characterizations, the stuff that I would keep in mind is that intelligence is a single axis of personality, and it affects the development of other axes in some profound ways, but there's really no such thing as a stereotypical genius. Intelligence is not a moral virtue, and it's not a social virtue. It can be a liability socially. Morally, it's basically neutral. People who are super intelligent don't have a higher claim to insight about anything involving wisdom, because wisdom is about practical things. However, what they do have the ability to do is to solve super complex problems, to sink very, very deep into aesthetics, to notice very subtle patterns in life, which may actually give them a leg up on wisdom if that's something they're inclined to otherwise. And they do tend more toward the obsessive. Not obsessive compulsive, which is a ritualized form of self-soothing by imposing order on the world, but towards the obsessive interest. Like if you'll find a TV show that you love and you just absolutely have to watch the whole thing, all of it, and then you get into the online forums and go deep into geekery on it for months and months. If you or someone you know does that, that's a characteristic of high intelligence. And the higher you get on the scale, the more prone you are to that kind of behavior, because you've got an engine in your car that's way overclocked. It's super souped up. It's like the human equivalent of a sleeper car. You get a Honda Civic that's got a Bugatti Veyron's engine in it or something. That's what it does for you. It doesn't affect athleticism one way or the other. It just affects the raw computing horsepower. That has another couple interesting implications. Really smart people are extremely dumb. They're prone to being extremely dumb, as in having bad judgment, not thinking critically, or failing at, once you get above 140, 150, the higher IQ does not predict success, and it can actually
there have been recent studies that indicate that that's not true.
Is that not true?
Okay.
Higher IQ continues to predict success with...
Even as it opens up the other failure modes I was about to talk about?
With the exception of people who have comorbid disabilities unrelated to their intelligence.
So what I just said was wrong. However, I'll give you a few typical failure modes that high IQ people fall into, the lower IQ people don't. They tend to be lazy, or they're more likely to be lazy in a particular kind of way, which is that because everything comes so easy to them, it is very easy for them not to learn how to learn. If they come up against difficulty in a subject that they're not obsessively interested in, they will just quit. Not true of all of them, but it is a failure mode I see much more frequently among highly intelligent people than among normal people. Now, you were talking about comorbid disorders, and that's actually worth talking about too, because there are two major classes of mental disorders that are comorbid with intelligence because they seem to share the same genetic basis. And they are autism and schizophrenia. People who have a very high IQ are much more likely to be autistic or on the spectrum, and much more likely to develop schizophrenia if subjected to the right stresses. Intelligence is not autism, and it's not schizophrenia, but what my current understanding of the genetics and the neurology is that the neurological architecture and the underlying genetic architecture that allows super high intelligence to flourish is very, very similar, sharing a lot of the same genes mixed in a slightly different way, sharing a lot of the same neurological architecture but wired up just a bit differently to autism and to schizophrenia. Autism especially in the first case and schizophrenia in the second case. Schizophrenia sharing more of the architecture, autism sharing more of the genes. Because of that, people who have schizophrenia and who are on the autism spectrum are much more likely to be super intelligent, which means that people who are super intelligent are more likely to exhibit these disorders than people who are not super intelligent. So that can lead to all kinds of fun stuff too. Example to writing characters more intelligent than you and doing it badly. A negative example is the television show Eureka. Eureka is a show about all the top geniuses in the world working on all the secret government projects, upper intellectual crust, and they are all dumb as rocks. It's not just that they're absent-minded professor types. By the way, the Disney film The Absent-Minded Professor is a really good example of a good characterization of a high IQ person who has a bit of social awkwardness about him, but who is very, very good at what he does and very smart about what he does. It's funny, too, which is nice. However, Eureka doesn't go for the absent-minded professor. It just has a bunch of people who are allegedly super geniuses, and they're all dumber than rocks, and the town sheriff, who is an average Joe, is smarter than all of them, but he's also dumber than rocks. And it's very, very difficult to take anything in the show, well, I would say seriously, except it's a comedy.
Well, let's see. The thing with that show, I see it as a comedy, and I enjoyed it because I was working at a national laboratory at the time, and I saw it as kind of a satire, a workplace sitcom of working in government bureaucracy. So from that perspective, it was absolutely hilarious. But if you were watching it as a science fiction drama, it made no sense.
Or even as a science fiction comedy. Yeah, it did get the bureaucratic mentality right. But it didn't get the super genius mentality right, or the unhinged creative mentality or anything. I have never seen so many idiot plots concentrated in such a short space. Every single episode is centered around a snafu at the government lab, which would never happen if you had even a slightly competent grad student running the place. Not only that, but many of them are easily fixable in the first scene. You're like, oh, just do that. And then they take a whole episode of not wrestling with the bureaucracy, but just sitting around looking dumb before they stumble onto the obvious conclusion. It's obviously a show where the writing room was peopled with humans that had an IQ of 110 to 125, which is not stupid. They're writing people who have an IQ of 160 to 190, and they're giving them problems that would be appropriate problems for someone of an IQ of 100. It's just awful. So if you want to see how not to do it, check out Eureka.
Agreed.
Now, the thing about writing intelligent characters is there isn't just a problem with writing highly intelligent characters. There's a really easy failure mode that'll come out when you write any character outside of your accustomed socialization range, especially one that's more than 5 or 10 IQ points away from you, unless you're a vertical socializer where you have a lot of friends who are all over the intelligence spectrum. So if your characters are much more intelligent than you are, you run the risk of having them trip up over problems that should be way too easy for them because they're not problems that are too easy for you. So putting extra effort into making puzzles and problems that would frustrate someone who is much more intelligent than you is kind of important. And also not having them trip over the same kind of stuff you'll trip over is. General intelligence, the whole phenomenon, not just IQ, will show up in processing speed as well as abstraction level. So if something gives you a hell of a problem but you can solve it with a lot of effort, then someone who is significantly more intelligent than you may solve the same problem with much less effort, even if it's still a problem they have to solve. So if it takes you an hour of niggling around, it might take them 5 or 10 minutes, that kind of thing. Or they may intuitively grasp it right quick. Depends on the kind of problem and the sort of genius that they have. Not all geniuses are the same either. You've got musical geniuses, mathematical geniuses. General intelligence is general, but people do tend to develop along domain-specific lines because of the disinclination to do difficult work because so much is so easy, which we've talked about elsewhere in this episode. So that's directly to your question, but you got to also keep in mind that if characters are dumber than you are, meaning if they have a lower level of general intelligence, you risk making them look too smart because you only give them problems that would be interesting to you. Or alternately, you condescend to them in a negative way. Condescension actually has a positive and a negative connotation. It's mostly negative in America because Americans don't like inequality. It's sort of down in our cultural bones. Genuinely, read back all the way to Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and to Alex de Tocqueville also. You'll see lots of talk about social inequality, which is different than economic inequality, but they do explore the ways that they interconnect. But the basic idea is that an American citizen is an American, and we don't like thinking about this person is better than that person in this respect, better in that respect, that sort of thing. We don't like hierarchies that aren't well-defined and contained and consensual. Goes all the way back in the national character to before the revolution. So it is a little bit uncomfortable writing characters that are less intelligent than you. So the natural thing is to make them look as intelligent as you are. This will really show up if you've got a character who's supposed to be severely mentally handicapped, or if you are a college graduate and you're writing a character who didn't graduate high school or who's illiterate or that kind of thing. They're going to have a different mental map of the universe, and they're going to get frustrated by different kinds of problems than you are. And they're going to prioritize different kinds of things. If they're trying to solve a logistical problem, if they're someone who navigates well socially, even though they don't have a very high IQ, they will prioritize social ramifications of solving the logistical problem over actually solving the logistical problem, and it can create a logjam in their life. Now, what I mean by negative kind of condescension is exemplified in the Forrest Gump books by Winston Groom. The movie Forrest Gump was sort of magical, savant-y, really charming, but didn't wear very well, because here you have Forrest, who is utterly, utterly stupid, so much so that his mother has to prostitute herself to get him into school because he's too dumb to pass the entrance exams. And yet, he's a savant with everything he encounters. Not just a savant with one thing, right? Not just having a gift for working with machines, which would indicate like a severe level of autism or something. No, he's a savant with everything he tries, which is, of course, ridiculous. But it's ridiculous in a charming and heartwarming way. Well, if you get the books by Winston Groom, it's almost the opposite. He's still got that savant quality. He still has interesting adventures. But the narrator in the book, the narrative voice, really dislikes Forrest. It's very, very cruel. It has a lot of fun at his expense. It doesn't see the world through his eyes. It sees the world through the eyes of someone who disapproves of his existence. And I've read both of the Forrest Gump books twice, and it was a very unpleasant experience for me, and I could never quite tell if what was going on was satire, where the narrative voice was disapproving, but it was satirizing the tendency to look down upon people who are less intelligent than you, or if the narrative voice was of a piece with the classic comedic tradition exemplified by some plays by Aristophanes, and that has come forward where the point of comedy is to have a butt of the joke. It's what some people today would call punching down, but it's actually, I think the technical term is vulgar comedy, where you're, it's very heavily schadenfreudish, where you're sort of taking amusement in the defects of another person. The Freak Show is another kind of comedy like this and whatnot. And there's times where this kind of comedy can work even to an American sensibility. But you risk unintentionally engaging in that kind of comedy or in that style of storytelling when you're writing characters who are significantly less intelligent than you. So it's really important when you're writing outside your own native intelligence range or your habituated socialization range to take care to see the world through the character's eyes and with the character's cognitive abilities. It's really hard, but it makes a huge difference in how effective the characterization is. I don't know if this has been helpful, but that's sort of a rundown on the way that super intelligent people really are.
I was thinking about fictional representations of genius, and it just struck me that some of my favorite fictional geniuses are the result of Dean Devlin. Seriously, Stargate, Dr. Daniel Jackson on Stargate, all the characters on Leverage.
That's true.
Most are all the characters on The Librarians. All of them highly intelligent geniuses. I would not be surprised if Dean Devlin is a genius.
Yeah, he obviously is. And fairly well characterized, too.
Fairly well characterized, and you see a wide variety of genius in these series.
And your stereotypical geniuses, people like House and Sherlock Holmes and whatnot, these are geniuses that have the social development problems that I talked about.
And those are well-characterized versions of geniuses with social issues. Please ignore, in terms of an example, Big Bang Theory.
Oh, it's terrible. Absolutely awful. It's just a terrible representation of genius.
Yeah.
What it is it's a caricature of a particular sense of humor that develops among geniuses.
Right.
The super, super multi-layered and abstract referential style of humor combined with the brute force show-offy type of humor. That does develop in communities of geniuses, especially. You see that a lot among Mensa members. But the characterizations of the people are terrible. They're not accurate at all. It's not the way that...
It's caricature of functional autism rather than a good representation of either genius or autism.
Yeah. The Big Bang Theory is what you would expect the jock in high school to write about the geeks in his class.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with what intelligent people are actually like.
I used to work at a national lab and university research center, and graduate students, professors, they are not like the people on that show. They really are not. They enjoy that show because they get guest appearances on it. But really, professors and grad students and college students in the sciences, they're generally normal people.
Who've got this one dial turned way up.
Who are trying to solve problems of how to get energy out of algae and know how to do it.
And in terms of the characteristic thought model, is the thing to look for in your characterizations of geniuses is patternicity. The ability to deal with symbols and symbol systems and the ability to discern patterns that other people can't, including false ones. It's an algorithmic thing. You notice regularities that other people don't. Who are some other great, well-characterized geniuses? We'll wrap it up with some good fictional examples. There's anything by Dean Devlin, really good, including, weirdly, Jeff Goldblum's character from Independence Day, as opposed to his character from Jurassic Park, which was terrible. That character in the book Jurassic Park, very well done, at Crichton.
Mm-hmm.
Crichton's books.
Wasn't he a medical student?
He was a medical student. He was about 150. He was a really, really sharp guy. Crichton was a genius who was also a very good observer of human behavior. And so the geniuses in his books tend to be very well characterized, though he gets something about intelligent people that most people don't get, either because they go too far with it or they don't get it enough, and that's the impatience. Intelligent people who are not super social or super well socialized do tend to be very impatient with other people because other people just can't keep up. And self-aware intelligent people get frustrated with themselves for feeling that because they know it's not reasonable. But they can't help feeling it anyway. So there is a constant source of internal conflict that can feed a general air of prickliness about them if this is a particular thing that goes on for them.
The impatience made me think of the scene from Zootopia. Is that the one with the police rabbit?
Yes!
where the police rabbit is talking to the sloth at DMV.
Yes, that's
her reaction.
That's the id of the super high IQ person talking to the id of the average person. That's very, very sharp. Yes, yes. Very good. Let's see. Who are some other well-characterized geniuses? Calvin in Calvin and Hobbes. Not kidding.
You're right.
Intelligent people also tend to be super creative, even if only in their specialized domains. And Calvin in Calvin and Hobbes is the quintessential childhood genius. Extremely well-characterized. Dan Davis from The Door Into Summer.
Yeah.
The point of view character in Heinlein's The Door Into Summer is a very well-characterized genius. I wish I could say anything by Asimov, because Asimov was incredibly smart, but Asimov was not a very astute observer of human nature, so his characters tended to be very flat.
Oh, Flowers for Algernon.
Was that Kurt Vonnegut?
I always forget who that was written by, but Flowers for Algernon, it's a classic science fiction story where the main character, through genetic experimentation and drug therapy, goes through a developmental curve from severe retardation to off-the-charts genius and then back again.
Daniel Keyes. Yes, and it is a terribly tragic story, but it's very, very good for studying for the way perception changes with intelligence level. Another good one from that era, very obscure book, I can't remember who wrote it, was Children of the Atom, which is about a bunch of mutant... It's the book that inspired the X-Men, actually. It's about a bunch of mutant kids who are super high IQ and undercover because they don't want to be treated differently than normal people. And then anything, really, anything by Kurt Vonnegut. Vonnegut was another one of those off-the-charts intelligent, but who had the common touch. And so he was really, really good at his characterization of people of all levels of intelligence. And especially his geniuses were incredibly written. I suppose that's enough of a reading list for one episode, huh?
Yeah, it's going to have a long resource list on that one.
Thank you very much for the question, Sarah. It's a really fertile question, as you can tell by the fact that we've been recording for 30 minutes here. And the episode will probably be 25, 26 minutes by the time we're done with it. Thank you very much for sending it in. Anyone else wanting to send in follow-ups, please listen to the instructions after the closing credits. And we will see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.